is capable of really amazing things. You know, we can grab hold of a slightest little thing, very small little word or gesture or implication. We hold on to that and we can make such a big thing about it. And yet, other times, sometimes really, really big things, huge things, we can let go of very easily. And one of the most important things that we can, or that we must learn about this, is that sense of wisdom that knows that keeps like a discernment there. So there's an understanding of right and wrong, good and bad. And that that's not confused with the issue of forgiveness. This is the hard part. I was just speaking with somebody today who was a number of years ago suffered a very terrible thing. He found out that he had a very close Dhamma friend who was his Dhamma teacher and mentor, guide in the Dhamma, and then he found out that this Dhamma teacher of his was sleeping with his wife. And this Dhamma teacher was widely regarded as at least a stream enterer, if not quite a bit more than that. Some people even asking whether he was an arahant. So Dustin asked me, can an arahant do it? No, Dustin. Oops, I shouldn't have. I have to edit that bit out. I didn't say no, Dustin. I said, my friend, I said, no, he's not an arahant. Can a stream enterer do that? No, a stream enterer can't do that. So, and of course this was very painful, and that whole period when the separation happened was very difficult, because there's all, of course, all of this growing suspicion, and people see things and they say things and blah blah blah, and eventually he had to sort of do this kind of detective work and track them down to one of them was going on holiday to, or on work to Hong Kong, the other one was going on work to Singapore. They used to work for the same company. And then he checked up the flight details and found out that the one who was going to Hong Kong was in fact going to Bangkok. And the one who was going to Singapore was also in fact going to Bangkok. Not to Singapore. Just somewhat unusual coincidence. And then found out that strangely enough that they booked into the same hotel. And then had to do the inquiry with the servants in the hotel to find out that surprisingly enough that only one of them, their bed was slept in that night. So that's the efforts that sometimes we need to go to find out these things. Of course, it's very difficult to trust those people who are closest to us. And what was very interesting about that was that this certain person who shall remain nameless never had any kind of sense of anger or ill will. Then, you know, there was a bit of kind of tension at that time when it was going on and there were kind of lies going around and stuff, but afterwards there was a complete kind of sense of forgiveness and a very kind of very genuine sense of forgiveness. And the wife left him, went to stay with this other fellow who had his own wife. I'm not quite sure what happened to her. And life went on, and my friend went on to became very successful. And as karma would have it, the other friend, the one who stole the wife, he ended up getting into a lot of financial trouble. And recently my friend just gave him a very large loan of money to get him out of his troubles. And my friend's new wife is actually helping the old wife to start a business. So the two wives have now become friends, and the new wife is helping the old wife to start a business, and so on and so forth. So that's quite sweet, isn't it? Yeah, that forgiveness. And he always said that to me at the time. He said, you know, when this is over, we'll be friends again. And so this is what he's done. So this is a very, very powerful act of forgiveness, isn't it? And of course we have another friend who is also in big marital troubles. Or we have a few of our friends in the monastery at the moment have very large marital problems and divorce and things like that, legal cases and all of those horrible things. And, you know, it's interesting, both of the people I know now who are going through that in regard to the monastery also are the same, even though they've suffered a tremendous amount of suffering. I mean, it's hard to imagine anything which is worse, really, in terms of just your emotional, just being ripped apart emotionally, then both of them actually have not said anything bad about the other person. Two separate cases. And despite everything that's happened, which in some cases is, in both cases, is quite outrageous and quite unfair, and yet there's not a single word of reproach, not a single word of blame, not a single word of harshness. And that's something I try to reflect about, and then try to look into my own speech and look at all the times when I've been blaming and critical and harsh, and then I think, well, you know, why should I be like that when these people are so much better in their speech, so much more gentle, so much more careful. And so for me it's a very good reflection on being able to improve myself and try to improve the way I relate. But one of the things which is crucial here is that we also have to keep this sense of discernment I mentioned at the beginning of the talk. And that means knowing the difference between criticism and fault finding and abuse and genuine discernment or understanding of the situation. And one of the things which is quite interesting in these, in some cases, is that if we don't have that, if we don't have that sense of discernment and being able to know what's right and wrong and to be able to articulate that, then sometimes that actually that can go wrong kind of both ways. It can go wrong more familiarly. We're familiar with the case where it can go wrong, where you become fault-finding and critical and things like that. You're just blaming externally. So you're sort of projecting outside all your problems and blaming everybody else is wrong. The government's wrong. The lawyers are wrong. The courts are wrong. My husband is wrong. My wife is wrong. The children are wrong. My friends are wrong. The law is wrong. The government is wrong. The courts are wrong. The children is wrong. My wife is wrong. The courts are wrong. The law is wrong. The government's wrong. Kevin Rudd is wrong. The courts are wrong. The police are wrong. The radio announcer is wrong. And so on and so forth. And that kind of keeps on going round in a very, very dreary and pointless circle, a little bit like samsara itself, actually, funnily enough. But so that one we're kind of reasonably familiar, well, certainly I will speak for myself here, that one I'm certainly very familiar with, and you know, that's something which is quite takes some getting used to. I remember my first range retreat at Pujomgom, and I had many wonderful hours there on my walking meditation path, you know, and the beautiful, I was there in this little cave, and there's just looking out over the Mekong River and the jungles of Laos, disappearing to the misty hills, and they say that you can see Vietnam on a clear day from there. It's an amazing place in this beautiful cave, and the weather's perfect, everything's perfect, and I just had this splendid, unequaled opportunity to blame everybody. And I could just spend hour after day, day after day on my walking meditation path, just criticizing anybody who I wanted to. And it was very useful because since there wasn't, in fact, anybody at all to blame, and everything was, in fact, absolutely perfect, then there was no limits on my ability to criticize anybody at all for anything whatsoever. There's no kind of rational boundaries on that. So that was a really wonderful opportunity, which I assure you I made full use of, and I didn't neglect the opportunity. No. Dedicated myself to finding fault with everybody who I could. And so that's how I spent my first range trip. Well, not entirely, or everything. I did. There were a few moments of actual meditation in there as well. But, you know, it did put it in that stark sense of contrast where you're thinking, you know, you really don't have anything to blame. And I really, for me, the conditions there, everything external was really absolutely ideal. I couldn't think of a way to improve it. Yet still, the mind wants to blame, criticize. So, that one we should be reasonably familiar with, okay? And, you know, we know how we should be developing the kind of positive states of mind, looking on the positive side, developing metta, and these kinds of things. And they will always help. And, you know, you can just adopt some rules of thumb. And that's, you know, you can, the rule of thumb, you know, just to, if you're going to criticize, you'd say something nice about something. And I remember there was a wonderful book review that was read in one of these Dhamma magazines years ago. And that was a book review of, what was that book, the Celestine Prophecy, that's right, the review of the Celestine Prophecy. And the review started out saying, well, my mother told me that if I'm ever going to criticize anybody, that I should always start out by saying something positive. So here we are. The font is very nice. There's a lovely picture of a waterfall on the front cover. There's no spelling mistakes as far as I can see. And then went on to completely rubbish the rest of the book, as was well deserved. So, sometimes you have to really strain a little bit, but it's always good exercise anyway, even just for the sake of it. So, and of course the flip side of that sometimes is also the seeing of just the positive. Sometimes they call the Pollyanna syndrome. And this is like you refuse to see anything bad in others. And this is very interesting when you see this happening in relationships, that what can happen sometimes is that failure to see any bad then in a way allows or perhaps even invites the development of the dark side in the other person. And so sometimes in a marriage, so that the two people are like a unit, they form kind of one unit, and the total positivity on one side then develops this kind of total negativity allows this total negativity to develop on the other side. And that's kind of very interesting to see. And of course that the cause of that, the problem there, is not the positive emotion itself, it's the lack of discernment. So this is why I'm making this point, is that discernment can know the dark side, it can know what is wrong, can know what is negative as well. If we're only, because focusing on the positive is good as an emotional attitude, yeah, it's that direction that allows you to move in the right direction. If you don't focus on what's positive, if you don't work from a creative and inspired place, then positive things don't happen. It's always possible to bring things down, yeah. And we've been talking about that a little bit in the community recently. For example, Ayati Muta brought up the example with bhikkhuni ordination, that you've got these kind of two paradigms. Of one is like, well, if you ordain bhikkhunis, then maybe they won't keep some rules, because some of the bhikkhuni rules are really hard to keep, like the rule that says you have to wake each other up 3 times in the night and say, "Sister, have you been violated?" "No, I haven't been violated, sister." Even though that's not actually a rule, of course, that's a kind of an interpretation in the old commentary. But some people, I don't know why, but some people think that nuns these days aren't going to want to keep that. I don't know. I certainly that doesn't apply to the nuns in this monastery, I would hope. And but one might wonder whether you could text each other or something. I mean, anyway, I'm sure that there are ways around it in this day and age. So then if they don't keep that rule, then maybe there might be other ones that they don't want to keep as well, like, emptying out the potty over the wall of the monastery or something. I don't know. There could be anything. So, you know, then because they might not keep some rules, then what might happen is that maybe some of the monks will pick up bad habits from them. And then some of the monks will stop keeping the rules. So, kind of an unusual argument in my experience. As a generalization, it usually doesn't take bhikkhunis in order to influence monks to not keep the rules properly. They're usually quite capable of achieving that without the help of bhikkhunis. But anyway, this is the kind of argument which we might hear from time to time. And therefore, everything's just going to go down the drain. Yeah, and so this is a kind of argument which you hear, and I've heard this kind of argument quite a few times in different forms and different places. And so it's interesting just to notice where that's coming from. And of course, it's coming. What is the basic motivation? There is fear. Okay, so fear, and so here fear is basically thinking that something bad is going to happen in the future. Okay, and you can have relatively rational fears and relatively irrational fears. Okay, so we should be able to get over all kinds of fears, so in the end fear can be surmounted completely, but there's degrees of difference in thinking of the amount of fear. So for example, thinking that being afraid that I'm going to be blown up by a terrorist is a completely irrational fear, because the amount of people in Australia, no one's ever been killed by a terrorist in Australia. So to be worried about that is completely irrational. Whereas on the other hand, to be afraid of, say, the impacts of global warming is a very rational fear. Global warming's obviously happening and it's obviously very dangerous. So to be concerned about that is quite a rational fear. So we can distinguish between these kinds of things. And so in this case of the projections that are placed on bhikkhunis, you can see that it's quite clearly an irrational fear. There's no actual evidential basis for it at all. There's no attempt to actually see what happens in communities of bhikkhunis. There's no evidence in to see how they actually relate to the Vinaya and what tends to happen in different communities and so on and so forth. It's entirely purely based on this kind of very narrow, kind of withered up, old kind of way of thinking. I shouldn't have said old way of thinking. Sorry, please, the elders in the room, please forgive me. I shouldn't have said that. Withered up like a dried up stick or something like that. This kind of way of thinking. And it doesn't get you anywhere. It can never accomplish anything. And this is one of the great... it's actually a really important thing about that, is that when, if you think in that way, the results will always be small and shriveled up and dried up and useless. And you'll never actually accomplish anything worthwhile. And so if you look at how things go in the world, then things are not accomplished by that means. Things are accomplished by a positive outlook which has a vision. So through a sense of vision, a sense of being able to imagine a future or a some kind of state which is better, and then putting the effort to accomplish that. And so we can see within the context of bhikkhunis, is that there's really two scopes or dimensions in which this dialogue is happening, and depending on which dimension that you're looking at it in, either if you look at the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis on the small scale, right? So we'll say within the context of the sangha, or a local sangha, a particular group of monks or nuns, or even within Buddhism as a whole, but certainly within the sangha. So it's a relatively limited perspective. Then from that perspective, the bhikkhunis are the underdog. Okay, the bhikkhus have got all the money, they've got all the power, they've got all the reputation. Their position is not at stake. They're very secure, and so the bhikkhunis feel like they're kind of an underdog. And so in a sense, they have to sort of fight to make themselves heard. They have to put an effort to articulate their position, whereas the bhikkhus don't. On the other hand, That's within a limited perspective. If you look at it from a bigger perspective, say the perspective of human culture, world culture, then it's exactly the opposite way around. From a perspective of world culture, the Bhikkhu Sangha is very small. It's like a small little island, and it's very beleaguered. The Bhikkhu Sangha has been tremendously threatened by modernity. It feels that it's irrelevant, largely because it is. And it has become irrelevant, and it has not succeeded always in making a new role for itself to become relevant. And this is an ongoing problem which Sangha has tried to address. It's addressed it with partial success. It's not completely failure. And, you know, give the Sangha its due. It's remained much more relevant, relatively speaking, than has, say, the Christian monastic orders. Okay, which have almost completely disappeared from relevance in modern Christianity. But so it still maintained some degree of relevance, but it still feels very threatened by that, and it feels this kind of pervasive kind of pressure of modernity, and it sees the bhikkhuni ordination as feminist, and it sees it as part of that, part of something which is much bigger than the Bhikkhu Sangha is, and which is very threatening to it. So each, depending on which perspective you look at it from a small perspective, it looks like the bhikkhunis are on the defensive and in the minority, and the bhikkhus are the majority. But if you look at it from a big perspective, it's the bhikkhus who are threatened, and they're operating within a context that has a UN Bill of Rights that says discrimination against women is wrong. They're operating in a context where they have a national constitutions in places like Thailand that say discrimination against women is wrong. And they kind of get away with it because of some kind of social history where this kind of privileged position is allowed to perpetuate for a while, but actually there's no real basis for it. Then you sort of get into all the legalistic arguments to try to preserve the basis for it. So this is, when we look at it like that, then you can see that there's actually, from the side of those of us trying to support the bhikkhuni movement, is that it's not, we shouldn't be trying to squabble on that local level or that small level of trying to persuade or convince the bhikkhus that they need to be, you know, accept bhikkhunis and things like that. But we need to move the dialogue into that big level. And when we move into that big level, we recognize that actually it's completely inevitable. The outcome, there's no question as to what the outcome of this process is. And this is something which I've believed very strongly for several years now. There's no question about will bhikkhunis be accepted in the Theravadan tradition and these kinds of things. The only question is how and when will that happen? That's the only question. So when we look at it from that perspective, then we need to be very gentle, because you know we don't need to be kind of excessively aggressive and so on and so forth, because we know that actually in the end we have that whole weight of history and the world culture is behind us, and we can rely on that. We can rely on the values that are generally accepted by good people in the world. And of course, by promoting and articulating a bhikkhuni sangha, we are creating a vision for the future of Buddhism which is going to be relevant and inspiring and meaningful within the world culture. And so that is the way that Buddhism can take its part and can play its role within that culture as a whole. So we can say that Buddhism will be able to hold its head up in society and say, yes, we acknowledge, we are big enough to say, yes, there were valid critiques of where Buddhism had gone. We've listened to those critiques and we've made the changes. And now, yes, the Bhikkhu Sangha used to be a boys' club. It used to be exclusive. It used to be male only. And no, this was not authentic Buddhism. This was not the Dhamma Vinaya taught by the Lord Buddha. Nor is it right, nor is it helpful, nor is it supportive, and nor is it appropriate within our cultural context. And we've changed that. We saw the problem, we've changed it, and now it's not like that anymore. And so we can do this. Yeah? We have this vision, and when that's happening, and as that's happening, then the Sangha will take its rightful place within Buddhism. And Buddhism can take its rightful place within the spiritual arena of humanity as a whole. And if we don't do that, those things won't happen. So that positive vision is what fuels and orientates a constructive and a constructive future, but that needs to go together with that sense of discernment. And so this is why we need to learn the difference between the discernment and the critical or the fault finding mind. And so if we're coming from a critical or fault-finding mind, then we look at kind of blaming. So we're blaming various monks, or this monk's done that monk's done that, or blaming people who are obstructing the bhikkhuni ordination, and we're trying to externalize the problem and blame the other. Yeah? And so this is not ever very helpful, it's very constructive. But we should not deny that that is the case, because it is the case. Okay. The question is not whether it's happening like that or not. The question is, what is the manner of the dialogue that is taking place? And this is what we need to try to point towards. If the dialogue is aiming towards harmony and integration and aiming towards solving the problems, then this is a a positive kind of dialogue, and this needs to happen, it needs to take place. But if it's just kind of criticizing and browbeating and so on and so forth, then it doesn't work all that well. And there's an example of a few week or two ago, and a good friend of mine sent some questions to one of the monks, and the first list of the questions was, isn't it chauvinist to deny the bhikkhuni sangha? So that was the first question, and all the questions followed that were like, well, if that's the case, then so and so and so and so, and so obviously that's quite an aggressive way of putting things, yeah. And it's good to try to build the dialogue on a more constructive kind of basis and not being aggressive about it. So for example, this is why when I spoke with Lumpur Liam, I didn't sort of try to persuade him to accept bhikkhuni ordination or anything like that, but I just said to him, what do you think about bhikkhunis? What's your opinion about bhikkhunis? And after that, then just let him know a few of the developments that had happened, but without sort of trying to push him in one way or the other. It's more important that we talk about it rather than have any one particular position or other. So this is a problem, and I can see that this problem that I mentioned before about the kind of the Pollyanna syndrome of seeing only the positive and refusing to see the negative. I can see that this can happen within the Bhikkhu Sangha as well, is that sometimes when we become ordained, we only want to see the positive side of ordination. We only want to see the positive side of being a monk. And in a way, that's a little bit coming from a place of lack of confidence, that we feel that if there's any criticism or acceptance of faults and so on and so forth, then maybe we're just going to disrobe or something like that. Yeah. So there's this feeling that we can't look at the what's wrong. We can only look at the good side of things. Yeah. And there's something wrong with us if we look at the bad side of things. So it's very important that we understand this, because what will happen is, again, that same problem is that we will then invite the dark side. If we refuse on principle to look at or discuss the dark side, then this is issuing an open invitation, okay, to say, please, dark side, grow. Yeah? Monsters of the deep, rear your ugly heads. Yeah? I'm going to ignore you, okay? I'll pretend that you're not there. Yeah? You can devour as many people as you want, yeah? And there'll be this kind of conspiracy of silence to kind of ignore what's happening. Did anybody here read Watership Down? Remember Watership Down, the little bunny rabbits? One of my favorite stories. And one of the little episodes that happened in Watership Down was the bunny rabbits that were trying to escape. They had to leave their home, and they were running across the countryside and trying to find a new home. And they found this new home, and it seemed too good to be true. And there were all these really lovely rabbits there. They're all very healthy and fat, and very, you know, they seem to get their food really easily, and so on and so forth. And it was really wonderful. Everything was really positive. But there was something a little bit weird going on, and they didn't quite know what it was. But, you know, they had plenty of carrots and cabbage and things. They didn't even have to eat the grass, because there was a kind farmer who used to live nearby, and he would leave out vegetables and things for the rabbits to eat. And so this is what they lived on. It was like dining on a feast. So they were all very, very happy, until they realized the truth, of course, was that the farmer was, every so often, would grab a couple of his nice, fat, happy rabbits and cook them up in his pot. Yeah? And so, but there was, of course, this conspiracy of silence that every few days one of the rabbits would disappear, or a few of the rabbits would disappear, and they'd never be talked about again. Yeah? And so this is that kind of syndrome of refusing to acknowledge the dark side, or refusing to acknowledge what's wrong. So this is why life gets a little bit complicated, doesn't it? Because we want to focus on the positive, and yet we have to, the dark side sometimes is there. Another example of this was an ad that was done some time ago for an anti-smoking campaign. And it was done in the form of like a satirical musical. And it was saying, and the theme of the musical was, let's just focus on the positive. And basically the idea was that the tobacco companies were saying, oh, you people talking about all the problems with cigarettes and smoking, you're always just focusing on the negative all the time. You're just fault-finding and critical. Why don't you focus on the positive? And so they did this kind of big band musical thing saying, let's focus on the positive. And so it had lines like, you know, there's a death from smoking once every 7 seconds. Once every 8 seconds or something, there's a death from smoking, but hey, let's be positive, let's focus on the 7 seconds in between. you're worrying about one death from cancer every 8 seconds, but there's 7 seconds when no one's dying from cancer. That's pretty good, isn't it? So this is the problem. So again, to the solution to the problem is, as far as I can understand or I can see it, is that you need to develop on an emotional level this positive outlook, which looks, you know, maybe 80% of the time at the positive and tries to focus on that, but also keeping an eye out for the negative and for the downside of things. And not denying it, not ignoring it, but not getting too worried about it either. Okay? But addressing it when it needs to be addressed. Acknowledging it, being aware of it, and addressing and dealing with it when it needs to be addressed. Okay? So this, something like this is the kind of the strategy that I use to try to cope with this problem. So this is my little talk for you this evening on the positive and the, positive and the negative, and how to deal with them in different situations. So I hope that's been of some use for you this evening. Does anyone have any comments or questions?
Not picking fault or trying to do that. So the sense of discernment, which sees that when there is something that needs to be addressed or something to do, should a rule of thumb be that whatever leads to... I guess when you were talking, what came to mind was remembering the Buddha's teaching to Udayana and to a bhikkhuni, I forget who, that whatever leads to peace and viraga and cessation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I forget what context that was taught in, but this discernment, like when to speak out or when to do something about something.
Yeah.
Should a rule of thumb be, okay, does this lead to peace? Does this lead to letting go, fading away, and then you act on it, and then you do something about it, and if it doesn't lead to that, then you just sort of let it be, and not to...
Yeah, and also, yeah, that's a good thing to bear in mind, but also to bear in mind that doesn't just mean, is that going to lead to peace for me right now? Yeah, because sometimes that can be an excuse for opting out of things, because I think it's going to be a hassle for me now to do this, therefore I won't, and therefore nobody ever does it. And it's very easy to use that kind of idea as a way of just deferring indefinitely a responsibility to actually play a part. So it's not just within ourselves, but also within our community. So that's important.
And the thing about, let's say, acting, when one thing that I notice that is difficult is when there's an intention, it's in the desire.
Mm.
But, and you think that, okay, maybe this should be done. But there's also, I don't want to do this now because I would be acting on my desire and I'm just reinforcing, you know, the sense that I'm in control and blah, blah, blah. So I should wait till the desire goes away to do something about it.
Yeah.
Could you sort of comment on when the appropriate time to do something and should wait till the... or how to distinguish between a desire that comes from the benefit of everyone, like, you know, when a desire comes, that,
yeah,
do you believe that the desire is actually coming from greed, or if it's no, this desire is wholesome because it actually leads for the good of everybody? You know what I mean? If you don't want to act on your desires, then after you have to do something.
Yeah.
Is it like a self-desire or is it a wholesome desire?
Yeah. Well, that's where you need your discernment, isn't it? Yeah. So you just have to do the best you can. You try to, you know, what's wholesome, what's unwholesome, and you try to see what's in there. So you get a feel for what's going on. Learn to... understand or learn to recognize kind of your own strategies, because we all have particular kinds of strategies that we use for making excuses about things and for justifying our own defilements. Yeah, and so we need to learn our own strategies, and when we can recognize them, and then you can know when those things are in place, and then you know the difference when it becomes from a place of letting go.
Discernment gradually,
right? Is that
what you're saying? Yeah. I'm just curious, in which way the Buddha spoke about discernment, or what was the words he used for this topic, and if you can think of some examples that from his discourses, or
discernment in the sense that we're talking about now.
Yeah. Like, is there a Pali word that's kind of the equivalent? Is there examples that he gave?
I mean, the normal word that's used is just pajanati, to understand. Yeah, and so it's like in the Satipatthana Sutta, you know, you just, when these different kind of mental states come, you just pajanati. Yeah, if it's with, it's affected by greed or hatred or delusion or whatever, then pajanati, I understand these things. Yeah, so that has its...
It's very different to just plain awareness. In the sense that you're aware of what's going on.
No, I think that there's a kind of a difference. It might, I mean, I wouldn't want to make it an absolute difference, but there's a certain sense of, like, it's a bit more like the suttas tend to use words like, say, words like, say, pachavekana, to review something or reflect on something, yeah, or patisanchikati, yeah, to reflect on something, and. And so that has, even though it's kind of interesting in Pali that though even those words are quite complex constructions. So patisanchikkhati or pachavekkhati and these kinds of words, there's actually like a few kind of prefixes, and it's quite a complex construction, and it has this kind of reflective meaning. It's a more complex reflective process as opposed to just pajanati, to just to clearly know something. And so there's something about being involved in a reflective process which, for example, appreciates how things happen over time, yeah, as opposed to like just a direct awareness of something, what's happening right at the moment. But also there's a reflective awareness, okay, you know, yesterday I did that, and then as a result of that, then today this has happened, yeah? And I can see that what I did, you know, so there's that reflective aspect to it. Which has an aspect, it's not divorced from direct awareness, because when that reflective process goes on, for example, you know, maybe just to think of some of the things I talked about in the talk. So for example, I might think, okay, when I spoke in such and such a way to such and such a person that was unwholesome, I reflect on that and that comes up. You can reflect on that and what the meaning of it is, but also the emotional reaction of that tends to come up again. Yeah? You relive it. Yeah, because there's an identity with that, so that it's relived, yeah? And so there's an aspect of the direct awareness of that that's relived. But at the same time, there's a reflective process going on.
Something else that I'm just thinking is that I kind of have a feeling generally in the when you read suttas, the Buddha doesn't seem to leave much room for grey areas.
Uh-huh.
Things are normally either
right
or wrong, and it's very black and white, whereas the discernment kind of seems to be almost about grey areas. How do I distinguish if this is right and wrong? And, you know, from the text, it would seem like there can be no two ways about it, and either you're right or wrong, and so discernment.
Yeah.
You know, either you stuff up or you get it right. But,
it's not quite as simple as that. It is true that as
don't ever seem to speak about this dilemma of how do I know if it's right.
Oh, no, there are places. Yeah, no, there are places that talks about that. Yeah, I mean, you're right in terms of a general thing that the suttas tend to have that fairly simple kind of black and white thing. But I think that should be understood more as an exemplar, which is giving like a clear case so we can understand what's going on. But there are certainly plenty of cases where it talks about those kinds of things. And obviously an example that springs to mind is it talks about doing black karma, doing white karma, doing mixed both black and white karma. And doing karma which is neither black nor white. Yeah? Mm-hmm. The karma which leads to the ending of karma. Mm-hmm. So that's one case, obviously, where it is you know, giving you that spectrum. Yeah. But, you know, it is true, and that's one of the things with the suttas and the teachings there, is that very often... you know, you're presented with two alternatives, but life is really a mix of those things, you know? And so you sort of have to try to understand the principle behind it and try to apply it as best you can.
Sometimes the Buddha said, like in the Sutta we read the other day, he says, it's not this, it's not that, and does it over and over again to make the big grey area, and then he says, actually, it just gives a very simple, straightforward answer.
Mm. And what's that? 42?
Yeah.
It's easy. It's not this, not that. Not the other. Yeah.
But it seems like it kind of just comes back to the awareness thing. Like it's not about the decision you make, but it's about your awareness of all the factors involved.
Yeah,
like
the
vajranati, just the awareness of what's happening.
Yeah.
And there seems to be a bit of an art that's involved with discernment, and negativity or unskillfulness comes up in the mind. You know, we so much want just one way to deal with it. You know, sort of squash it, to push it, to remove it, to preferably cut it out of my spiritual presence, you know, to all these ideas. Spirituality, you know, we know the paramis and we can recite them, and you know, we're trying bit by bit, year by year, to try and develop them and water them. And, you know, we're making progress in that area. But, you know, when we honestly look inside, you know, there's all the black and the white.
Yeah.
And, I mean, just how to be real and genuine with that. And to look, I think, my own experience sometimes thinking or being associated or being on a spiritual path, which is so important and so special to me, sometimes can
if I hold it in the wrong way, actually hinder me, stop me from actually just being genuinely real with the experience that's coming up. You know, so, yeah, I think to look inside and see things that are unskillful, and to be honest and see the real fear that's around those, because in my mind I've got an idea of spirituality, oh dear me, it can't be that. But the reality is, until we come into a different understanding and acceptance of that, we can't integrate it. And it seems to be my experience through integrating that, actually that's where the compassion can come from, because you look inside and you say, oh, gee, there's a bit of a pickle going on here, and I can't accept the story that it's the person outside that's the problem. To own it as your own, and, you know, not to drown in it, but just to be, to try and learn to be real with it in a different way and integrate it. And it seems to be quite a humbling experience. So the whole idea of black and the white, knowing how to, you know, remove it, doesn't sort of seem to work that way, because, you know, each time we develop different things that can maybe, you know, with anger we can develop metta, definitely, and we feel the effects of that, but to actually just allow it to be there for a moment and grace it as part of, you know, what we are too, just to give it the space also seems very healing, and that seems to be more the art side of it than the 1 + 1 = 2.
How can we act and be authentic when underneath we feel shameful of who we are and what we've done?
I guess first of all by being honest. To remember that the things that we've done that we maybe feel ashamed of, they're no more real, they're no more us than anything else that we've done. So you know, sometimes they can obsess our minds, and that you can think that it's the kind of the real, you know, the real me is a strong identity with those things. But actually, of course, there is no real me. It's just a thing, it's just an act, it's something which has been done at a certain point in time for a certain reason in a certain way, that's all. And everybody has those things in their past, and we're very lucky, we don't have to, as Buddhists, we don't have to purify all our past karma. Because I know that some of us would be here for a long time if that was the case. Certainly I would. And so we just have to purify our minds right now. Yeah. And so this is always the thing. As long as we're clear in our mind what's right and wrong now, and that we're okay, if we can determine to try to do better in the future, then that's all that anybody can ever ask of us. So we need to keep on reminding ourselves that this is not, it's not about just being necessarily but Mr. Perfect all the time. But it's about sort of recognizing when there are imperfections and trying to do something better about them. And so those feelings of shame and guilt and things come up. But as long as you're not actually doing the things that are going to cause it to come up more, then they will tend to gradually die away by themselves, little bit by little bit. Yeah, they'll take their own good time about it. But if there's no fuel, then they'll gradually die down. Maybe you just take a few lifetimes to get over it. Usually quite shorter than that, but it depends.
Slightly related, but a little bit unrelated question. I was in Wanacha about 10 years ago.
What year was that? 10 years ago was 1998, I know that.
No, 90, I think it would be 96, so it's like 12 years ago.
Okay.
When I was there, Ajahn Sumedho was there for his birthday and someone gave him a big statue. I've got no idea if you... I can't recall you.
I was around at that time. Ajahn Sumedho got a big statue.
Well, he got a little, got a statue. He was there for his birthday. I was only there for about 9 days.
What month was that?
July.
July is his birthday. July. Yeah, look, I can't remember if I was there or not.
Anyway, my question was that I was kind of... it was fairly early in my meditation practice, and in a way I was there with the feeling of, if I feel all wonderful at the monastery or I was ordained, if everything seems like that's the way to go. But I didn't have any clear idea, and what I felt when I was there is that I had the feeling that some of the monks were running away from the life that they had before they ordained. But that's not the feeling that I had about everyone there.
Yeah.
And so my feeling was that, everyone here still has a ton of rubbish that they're working with, and so it wasn't this idealized picture of some kind of a, monastic heaven or life that I thought it might be.
Yeah.
So I just wonder if... And so what I think...
That's not an uncommon experience, yeah.
Right, sure. Idealization. But so my feeling was somehow that, as far as ordination is concerned, and this comes back to the thing of shame and... is that, do you also see this, that you feel that some people ordain to get away from who they think they are, or to get away from a situation that they don't like, and some people ordain to go towards towards a meditation practice, towards liberation, towards better qualities, and that there's this two different approaches that
For sure, yeah. Except, I think so. But again, it's not black and white. But as a tendency, absolutely. No doubt. Some monks ordain because their lives are just crap. They've been through all kinds of things, and some of the monks have been through very, very difficult times. And they've been drug dealers, or they've been all kinds of things. And some ordain to out of fear of women. Some ordain because of excessive love of women, and it's got them into trouble, so they need to get away. Others don't know anything, so they try to escape, deny their feelings. All of those things, yeah, and it's all there.
In the end, it all comes out in the wash, and it doesn't really matter why you've ordained.
No, it doesn't all come out in the wash. it stays there, and. Yeah, it's a serious problem. Yeah, it's a serious. It's a very complex issue. It's one thing. It's complex because we've all got a bit of both in us. So one might predominate or not. But in cases where monks ordain from a negative reason, trying to get away from things. Then not infrequently they will end up disrobing, okay? But that might take 30 years, right? And then at the end of 30 years they're ready to get married, yeah? And they needed that 30 years, yeah, maybe? I don't know. So yeah, there's certainly I'm just reflecting back, on people that I would think about like that certainly a reasonable proportion of them would end up disrobing. But that's not by no means hard and fast rule, and that there's some people who you think probably should disrobe who don't, stubbornly, belligerently, malignantly, they stay. And even though sometimes you're thinking, what are they doing? Yeah, and very hard to know why, and then so this can be very problematic. So that's one problem. On the other hand, of course, it can also change. And you've got the classic example, like Nanda is sort of ordained out of, because he wanted the 500 celestial pink-footed nymphs, you know, and then later on, yeah. Nanda, not Ananda.
Oh, right.
Nanda, the Ananda's cousin, I think. He wanted these 500 pink-footed nymphs. So that's why he abandoned his wife on the wedding day. Well, because the Buddha said, you can, Nanda, you know, go become a monk. And he said, I can't, I'm supposed to get married, I've got this beautiful wife. And the Buddha said to him, okay, come with me, Nanda. So he took him up to heaven and showed him the celestial pink-footed nymphs. And then said, what do you reckon now? How does your wife look to you now? And he said, well, now compared to those pink-footed nymphs, my wife looks like a bald she-monkey with her nose and ears cut off. So why don't you become a monk? He says, riffer, I'll become a monk. I'll guarantee you 500 pink-footed celestial nymphs, says the Buddha. So, but then later on the monks would have made fun of him. Actually, Nanda was the first metrosexual. Right? He used to iron his robes, he used to wear makeup, yeah? Glaze his bowl, and he was funky. So the monks used to laugh at him and giggle and so on, as monks do. And then so eventually he got real and got serious and practiced and of course became an arahant. So sometimes it can change, and that's, you know, I mean, that's a fable, but, you know, it can happen for real. There are cases where people ordain for various kinds of reasons, and then they only really get serious about practice maybe after they've been a monk for quite some time. Yeah?
Mind you, he wasn't trying to get away from something. He was still trying to get towards something.
Oh, you could look at it that way. Yeah, he still had a positive outlook. Yeah, that's true. Mm.
Is it something that you try to address with people that come to you wanting to enter the monastic life?
Yeah. It would. Yeah, depend on the person, but definitely, I think it should be. Yeah, if you really think that someone's coming from that negative space, I think that needs to be just talked about.
I felt like it was very different in Burma. Just people's attitudes to ordination. There's so much suspicion in the West, well, I don't know the West, but maybe in Australia,
mm-hmm.
towards, you know, people's intentions in their ordination, you know, and there's something wrong,
mm-hmm.
bad. Even
yeah.
from other monastics as well.
Right.
And it was very refreshing to have this attitude in Burma. It's just like, sadi, 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 do you want to do it?
Yeah.
And you know, if you disrobe, you disrobe, and otherwise, great that you did it for 24 hours or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, it's there's a lot of goodwill.
Yeah. And yeah, I think recognition that the basic thing what you want to do, of course, is really fantastic. So, yeah, that's really good. Okay, let's
Mm-hmm.
Paribham. Bye.